The Oklahoma legislature is back in session today after a largely inactive week last week. The legislature has already passed one big deadline this session. Bills that have not passed through their chamber of origin are now dead. Today on Oklahoma Voices, we'll talk with Dale Dinwalt. He covers the State House for the Journal Record newspaper. We'll also hear from Sean Ashley of eCapital. This interview was recorded last Friday. I first asked Sean Ashley if the legislature has taken up bills that address structural issues that lead to budget crises like the one the state now experiences.
Well, I would have to say not a lot. I sat through a number of Senate Finance Committee meetings early on in the legislative session where they took up a number of measures that would have cut back tax credits and even rolled back the individual income tax cut that took effect on January 1st. But when it came time for those bills to move across the floor, they disappeared. They were not heard. And in a way, we had been promised that. Senator Brian Bingaman, the Senate President pro tem, had said that the bill rolling back the tax cut probably would not be heard. There were some concerns in opposition to a number of the tax credit proposals. On the House side, however, one did make it across the floor, and it contains a large number of different tax credits and rolls them back in one way or another. But in the grand scheme of things, it really doesn't generate that much money that could be used to offset that $1.3 billion shortfall.
I'd have to agree with Sean. There hasn't been a whole lot. And one explanation that I think is that when lawmakers usually about this time are dealing with one budget, that's next year's budget. This year, because of the revenue shortfall and the revenue failure, they have had to deal with two budgets, the one we're currently in and the next one. So when you start thinking about cuts, you start thinking about painful cuts. And so it makes sense that the legislature would wait a little bit, make sure they have everything right, and we'll probably see something fairly late.
Have there been any conversations about structural changes, those structural long-term changes that that can help avoid this type of situation coming again during the next oil and gas bust cycle?
I would have to say not so far. There is one proposal advanced by Senator Clark Jolly, who's chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, that would form a task force to look at Oklahoma's tax structure. You're exactly correct. Part of the problem here is structural, and that's something State Treasurer Ken Miller has been pointing out for a number of years. Before becoming treasurer, he was head of the House Appropriations and Budget Committee, so he saw the dirty inner workings of our state budget. Also, the Oklahoma Policy Institute and David Blatt have pointed out that there are a number of structural problems with our budget. And it's not simply the credits themselves and the way our budget process works, but we've tinkered with it so much. And I think that's one of the things that Senator Jolly's task force could look at. I was talking to Tony Mastin, who's the director of the Oklahoma Tax Commission, several weeks ago at a Senate Finance Committee meeting. And he pointed out to me that right now, for example, the gross production tax on oil has seven different rates that people are paying because of all the changes that have been made in that tax over time. And that gets to those structural problems which you're referring to. We have a very convoluted tax and budget structure, and it's hard for people to get their arms around exactly what's going on.
Really, the only thing that I've seen is the Incentive Review Commission that was passed into law last year and can finally has just recently started meeting. That they're going to take a look at the tax incentive tax credits that have been given out over the years to corporations. But the problem with that is that they really won't start telling lawmakers their recommendations until like next year, and then it'll take probably another year to see any fiscal effect from that. Also, another way to prevent these gross production shortfalls is increasing the cap on the rainy day fund that Senator David Holt has proposed. Basically, it would increase it by fourfold. The problem is that we would significantly have to change how money is put in there and how much money is put in there, because right now we're really not even getting close to the cap. And so if we want to save back a lot of money for the rainy day fund, you know, billions of dollars, then at some point we're going to have to figure out how to actually fill that cap.
Now, because his proposal proposes to put not a certain percentage of appropriations into the rainy day fund, but the overall budget, and appropriations is only what, about a quarter of the state budget or something like that?
That's right. And if you take a look at the entire money that's spent by the state, not just appropriations, but all the money, you're talking about something worth of $20 billion.
Besides the wind industry, are there any other particular industries who are really going to have to fight to keep their tax incentives or tax credits? Are there any kind of low-hanging fruit there for the legislature to look at?
I think we saw some of those fights early on in the Senate Finance Committee and in the House Revenue and Tax Subcommittee. One of them, of course, was the historical renovation tax credits, which seemed to be on the chopping block, but quickly they were able to rally and say, look, we have these projects that are in process, and that if you take this credit away, these projects go away. And these projects these credits or similar federal credits have been used for projects like the Skirvin in downtown Oklahoma City. There's a school that's going to be converted into some other space using these credits. And that one in particular was at risk of losing its financing if the credit went away. Keep in mind, every one of these tax credits has a constituency. There's someone who came to the legislature and asked for that credit in one way or another. Years ago, I was here when the legislature passed a tax credit for essentially those little cartons you buy your mushrooms in, because there was a company growing in eastern Oklahoma that was selling mushrooms. They're still around today, in part perhaps because of that credit. They no longer get that credit. But they had a lobbyist working on their behalf who was able to get that. And it amounted to hundreds of thousands of dollars for them, but it allowed their business to grow over time. And then eventually they were able to operate without the benefit of that credit. So there's always a constituency, whether it's mushrooms or historical tax credits or wind farms or the oil and gas industry.
In Governor Fallon's State of the State address, she proposed sales tax exemptions and looking at what some other states like Texas were offering in sales tax exemptions. Has this been addressed at all up to this point, Dale?
The only people talking about the sales tax exemptions are the Democrats. This is a politically tricky question. The Democrats are saying you're going to raise taxes on the middle class. You're going to start charging for haircuts, collecting taxes on haircuts and things like that. This is very politically tricky, and I don't think that we're going to see anything until later on in the session. Now, depending on how this is introduced, the legislature may have this as part of the budget agreement, because if they can start collecting these sales taxes next year, they can say, well, look at this increased revenue. We can fill part of this budget hole that we're expecting. And so later on this session, we may see something. Now, they've kept it quiet. The Fallon administration has said that we're not going to tell you these sales tax exemptions that we're going to get rid of, because we're using them as a negotiating tool. And so that's why I don't think we're going to see anything until later.
Well, one thing to keep in mind, we heard this in the governor's State of the State speech, and oftentimes others will repeat it. They talk about the $7 to $8 billion of sales tax exemptions. But it's important to keep in mind that half of that amount is the manufacturer sales tax exemptions. It's kind of like the mushroom carton in a way. And that is when Johnson Controls down outside of Norman buys a washer or a hose for the air conditioners, which they're manufacturing. They don't pay sales tax on that. That accounts for about half of that $7 to $8 billion of sales tax exemptions that are out there. So now we're talking with a much smaller number that we can work with. And as Dale pointed out, once again, the sales tax exemptions have constituencies, and the governor's office and her negotiators are worried about those constituencies rising up, and whether it be barbers or newspapers or advertising agencies, all which receive a sales tax exemption, they don't want them out here lobbying to protect themselves. Dale's right. It will be part of the budget process in the end, and it may be sometime in May before we actually see what they're targeting and where that's going to go.
Another point on sales tax exemptions, there is legislation advancing that would start for collections on online sales, online purchases. So, you know, if you go buy a T-shirt, you don't pay a sales tax unless that company already collects it and remits it to the state of Oklahoma. So I think that's something that is moving through the legislature right now. Everyone seems to be on board. The governor wants it. She talked about it. She put it in her budget this year.
Let's talk about some of the big cuts that have already been proposed. And I'm really thinking about Representative Doug Cox's bill that cuts 110,000 able-bodied, non-pregnant recipients from the Medicaid rolls. I mean, first, I mean, is this really something that the state can do with something that receives federal dollars like this?
Well, they say it's going to save like $130 million in what the state spends on health care. But on the other side, what people are saying is that this is going to shift the cost onto hospitals that are really already struggling to get by. If this bill passes, you'll have to get a waiver from the federal government. And I'm not sure that any administration, Republican or Democrat, is going to say, unless you come up with some kind of viable way to get these 110,000 people on some kind of insurance or to pay for their health care or do something, I think that they're probably going to say no.
I think Dale's exactly correct. It's not simply a matter of the legislature passing the bill. It's a matter of the federal government agreeing to go along with this.
Let's talk a little bit about legislation that we think might have some legs to it that might end up making it through the legislature this year. One is a House bill that was named after the late Labor Commissioner Mark Costello that would help mentally ill people stay in treatment. What exactly does this bill do, and is this enjoying bipartisan support right now, Dale?
It has unanimous support so far. The version that was introduced on the Senate floor last week and passed through, it was kind of a surprise. This bill is from last year, but the version that was introduced, the Senator A.J. Griffin, the author of the bill, told me that it's a somewhat narrower version, but it still accomplishes what Kathy Costello, the wife of the late Labor Commissioner Mark Costello, it accomplishes what Kathy said is a bittersweet policy change. And what it does is basically allows families and doctors to say if someone is currently undergoing mental health treatment but they're not in a hospital and they're not in jail, a doctor or their family can say, courts, why don't you watch over our son or our daughter?
And this is something Senator Griffin as well as Representative Lee Denny have been working on for a number of years. They've had bills in previous legislatures that didn't make it this far. It may be the tragedy involving former labor commissioner, the late labor commissioner Mark Costello, that has put it more in the forefront of some legislators. But as Dale said, I think a key to this is that they have narrowed the playing field in a manner of speaking. The bill has very specific criteria for court intervention in these people's lives and the way in which they will intervene. That was a concern in the past that you were giving the court too much leeway and you were perhaps encompassing people who might not otherwise need the court's supervision to see that they receive proper medical treatment. The concern as this goes forward is going to be the cost. The original version of the bill had a fiscal impact, a potential cost of $6 to $10 million. That's money that the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services certainly doesn't have and probably is not going to get in this tight budget year. The Commissioner Terry White there will tell you that already in the state that there is a shortage of mental health beds. but she has advocated for this measure because it does keep, it does intervene in people's lives before they reach the need for an institutional setting. It tries to divert them and intervene earlier in the course of their disease before they get there and need that kind of treatment. So she has been an advocate for this. She testified before both the House and Senate committees that looked at it, and I believe has been involved in helping to improve the legislation as it's moved along.
Well, and she said numerous times that the way that the mental health system works in Oklahoma right now, you don't get treatment until until you're in danger or until you're endangering the lives of others. Folks who need that preventative service don't often get it.
Right. And when there are those services offered, in many cases, currently because of the budget situation that has existed for several years, there are waiting lists. Commissioner White also points out, though, the success her department has had over the last several years. If you look back to the Henry administration, when she was first appointed, she was one of the advocates behind the Smart on Crime initiative that Governor Henry introduced that has made some progress in bits and pieces over time. And now we see even more efforts with that taking place with justice reform and those proposals. But as she points out, the money that the agency has received and has been able to deploy in preventative type programs, much like the assisted outpatient treatment, she says has saved the state tens of millions of dollars. So she makes the case that every dollar you invest in this type of treatment is going to save you money over time. And it's a matter of then for the legislature to find that money, whether it be assisted outpatient treatment or her other programs, to get the proper funding and make those services available earlier on.
Well, you mentioned Smart on Crime and criminal justice reform, which has also been fairly significant this legislative session as well. Now, I understand it, though, that might be something that goes to the ballot this year, correct?
Yes, there's one proposal right now where petitions are being circulated to bring to the vote of the people a series of reforms to our justice system. The idea is to, much like in the mental health sphere, for those who have committed nonviolent offenses, not to find their way as quickly into prison as they currently do. Oklahoma has some very stringent criminal sentences, but this focuses on the nonviolent and would attempt to divert them into other programs or in some cases lessen sentences so that they didn't go immediately to prison, or if they did, they didn't serve as long periods of time. At the same time, there are a number of legislative pieces that are working their way through the process. Four bills authored by Representative Pam Peterson out of Tulsa passed the House and have now moved over to the Senate. And several of these would lessen criminal sentences, again, focusing on the nonviolent offender and not rushing them into the Department of Corrections system, trying to reduce prison population and the cost involved there, and to give these people an opportunity at rehabilitation from their criminal ways outside of the prison system.
How much enthusiasm is there in the legislature for these types of criminal justice reforms from that Peterson has proposed?
That's always an interesting question, because what happens for a lawmaker is they run the risk of being accused of being soft on crime. And that's one reason that we have such a stringent criminal justice system in the state of Oklahoma. When legislation to increase sentences for various crimes have come before lawmakers, it's tough to vote against them, because if you don't, you're soft on crime. Now you're reversing that course, and you're trying to say, well, we're going to lessen some of these sentences. The way these measures are being presented, though, in saying, as the governor did in her State of the State of speech, that for certain drug offenses, we've gone too far. For certain property crimes in which there was no violence and no one was hurt or injured, we've gone too far. That gives politicians cover. They can say these sentences were too tough, they were too strong, and we needed to back off on them. And if you look at our prison system, and you look at our county jails, for that matter, too, you often hear that they are the main places for mental health services in the state and for drug rehabilitation services in the state. And so they're trying to move that out of that system and back into the community by reducing those sentences.
And talk about political cover. We have a public safety issue and a budget issue, because Department of Corrections is, they say, bursting at the seams. They have so many people who have been put in jail because of new felonies over the years, increased sentences, that this is just another reason to change how Oklahomans or people are put in prison.
Let's talk a little bit about the Empowered Schools Act. This is something, Sean, that you had mentioned that you think does have some potential for making it through the legislature.
Yes, this bill, Senate Bill 1187, passed the Senate a couple of weeks ago, and what it does is it allows local school districts and local schools to operate somewhat like a charter school. And by that, what the legislation does is it allows those schools to choose not to follow some of the normal state mandates that schools are expected to follow. And that includes things like the minimum teacher salary, contributions to the teacher's retirement system, and a list of others. The idea is, though, that schools could then choose how to operate more efficiently. Senator Clark Jolly, the author of the legislation, pointed to a couple of administrators who had written to him endorsing the legislation, who seemed to suggest that, for example, they, rather than hiring a full-time teacher to teach certain classes, what they might look to do is to hire someone on a part-time basis, which really under current law is very, very difficult to do because, again, you're expected to pay that minimum salary. You're expected to make contributions to the retirement system. So this would allow some part-time instructors to find their way into the classroom, which would be more, would create savings for the districts. Of course, the various teachers' organizations are leery of the legislation, if not outright in opposition to the legislation. But Senator Jolly points out that where there is collective bargaining, those bargaining units would have to approve whatever plan was adopted at the district level. And keep in mind, it isn't just that a school can say, this is how we're going to operate, and we don't have to follow those mandates anymore. They have to develop a plan, which must be approved by the local board. It must also be approved by that local bargaining unit, if there is one. It then goes to the State Board of Education for review and approval. So there are several approval steps involved. It just won't be everyone running willy-nilly around doing whatever they want to do.
That's really, it's really interesting, especially considering the teacher pay raise issue, which, I mean, there hasn't been a pay raise one in 8 years for educators here. There have been a lot of proposals, though, to tackle this. Which one has the clearest path to getting teachers a pay raise this year?
Well, one of the reasons that we have a lot of proposals for teacher pay raises is because it's an election year, and people like to be nice to teachers when it's an election year. I don't think really that we're going to see anything. But, you know, lawmakers have said actually earlier this year that really there's no chance. Now, Senator Holt, we mentioned him earlier, introduced legislation that would have a $10,000 teacher pay raise. But the problem with that is that maybe not a problem, but the issue that you run into with that collection of bills that he's proposed is it's based on external factors like you have to consolidate schools, you have to divert off the top revenue growth, and you have to eliminate some tax credits. Now, those are three things that are at least controversial and at worst politically inviolable.
There's a lot of moving parts there that all have to connect in order to make that proposal work.
That's exactly correct. And if I recall correctly, none of Senator Holt's bills made it across the Senate floor by the most recent deadline. And I was trying to recall, I don't believe a House bill made it out of the House related to teacher pay.
Dale, I want to ask you a little bit about judicial reform. Explain to us a little bit kind of what some of these judicial reform proposals entail. And is this something that we're looking at this year?
Well, this all kind of started with Representative Kevin Calvey. If you'll remember last year, he had a really memorable outburst on the House floor criticizing the Supreme Court for making its decisions on abortion laws and overturning legislation passed by the legislature so often. So he proposed having elections for judges, basically if letting the people decide if the Supreme Court is doing its job right. Now, this came under tremendous pressure from the legal community and from those in the legislature who hearken back to a day when Oklahoma elected its judges and saw a judicial scandal that was looked at nationwide and really kind of laughed at because of bribes and whatnot. So I think the leaders in the legislature and the legal community want to keep an independent judiciary free from elections. And now, obviously, there are retention ballots, but if you were to introduce elections, you would have campaigns raising millions of dollars, and that presents a problem. Is that a conflict of interest? Now, what we will see, most likely, is a compromise introduced by Speaker of the House Jeff Hickman that would take a lot of power away from the Judicial Nominating Commission. Now, that's a group of people who recommend to the governor who to appoint to appellate and Supreme Court vacancies. Now, the bill introduced by Hickman, which is a compromise, and I think primarily is meant to quieten the voices who want judicial elections. What the bill does is it forces the JNC to present all of the eligible candidates to the governor rather than just the top three. But the good thing here, if you oppose the election of judges, is that it avoids the election of judges. Now, one thing it does do, though, is it requires a confirmation by a collection of lawmakers, a select group of House and Senate members who will take a look at the governor's appointment and say yes or no.
Now, we only have a couple of minutes left here, guys, so I want to ask both of you what you think we are going to see in the this legislative session, your predictions, I suppose you could say, for legislation that we'll see pass, and so far, what do you think have been the biggest surprises that we've seen?
I'm really surprised that we haven't seen the legislature act more quickly to stop the bleeding on the budget. You know, there could be changes to the tax code, structural changes to government that would take a little bit more time, but also options for revenue bills. There have been some agency consolidation bills that have made it through, and actually the first bill that Governor Fallon signed was a consolidation of the Will Rogers Commission with the Oklahoma Historical Society. But really, those are kind of small potatoes. This tells me that the second half of the session is going to be a lot more surprising. Because as lawmakers reach the 11th hour on deals and really wait to the end of the legislation to introduce painful or controversial legislation.
I'm going to agree with Dale. And at first, I was surprised when I watched the Senate Finance Committee and when I watched the House Appropriations and Budget Committee how few measures related to the budget of bringing additional money in were passing. But we need to remember that a couple of years ago, the legislature bifurcated the budget process. They took it out of the main legislative process. Now its bills can be filed at different times. They're not subject to deadlines. So everything we saw early on, I think, was sort of running the flag up the flagpole to see how many people saluted. And right now we know not a lot of people did. There is some concern there. But as we move into these last couple of months of the legislative session, what we could see are some of those same proposals reintroduced in what we call the Joint Committee on Appropriations and Budget, JCAB, or the General Conference Committee on Appropriations. These are areas where they can still pass policy bills. They can roll back the tax cut. They can make changes to tax credits and things like that. They can do those, as Dale said, in the final few weeks of the legislative session. And that makes it even more difficult for the proponents and opponents of those measures to get their act together and to challenge them. So I think we'll see a rather hectic final month in particular.
And also wanted to say that these next 2.5 months is the really the last opportunity for leadership in the House and Senate, and I'm talking about Republicans, to make a case that they're handling this budget crisis. There's an election in November where all of the House is going to be up and half the Senate is going to be up for re-election or open seats. And so what we could see is them making a case, introducing legislation, getting it passed to allow them to say during the general election and even during the primary election season, we did what we could, and this is the best thing that we could have done.
We've been talking today with Dale Denwalt from the Journal Record newspaper. Also, Sean Ashley from eCapital. Gentlemen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Glad to do it.
Thank you for joining us today for Oklahoma Voices. You can find this conversation on our website, kgou.org. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of KGOU, our staff, or the University of Oklahoma's Board of Regents, which holds our broadcast license. I'm Jacob McClelland. Thanks for listening.